You see it every single season, right? The frost hits the air, and someone decides this is the year they take up ice hockey. Or maybe they're outfitting their kid for their first real season.
Yeah, it's a very familiar ritual.
It really is. And they walk into the pro shop, hand over a credit card, and just drop an absolute fortune. I mean, we were talking top of the line, everything. Aerospace grade composites, carbon fiber boots, helmets engineered in wind tunnels. They just buy the absolute pinnacle of retail technology.
And, you really can blame them. The instinct is entirely rational when you think about it.
Right, because it's terrifying.
Exactly. It is an inherently dangerous, high-velocity sport. You want maximum safety for yourself or your kid, and you figure, well, if a piece of equipment costs $1,000, it must inherently make you a better player.
But then they actually step onto the ice, and it's a total disaster. They look completely rigid. They can hold an edge on a turn. They're wobbling. Passes are skipping right over their stick, and they're just exhausted after 3 minutes.
Because they've completely misunderstood the assignment.
Right. It is the equivalent of buying a multi-million dollar Formula One chassis, bringing it to the track, and slapping underinflated minivan tires on it. All that advanced engineering is completely neutralized because the interface with the environment is fundamentally broken.
Which really points to a massive blind spot in how people approach sports gear generally, but hockey equipment specifically.
Yeah.
People assume equipment is just, a passive shell you wear, like a winter coat.
Yeah.
But hockey gear is actively doing two entirely separate, highly demanding jobs at the exact same time.
And most people only think about one of them.
Right. Job one is keeping you out of the trauma ward,
Yeah.
managing kinetic energy from pucks, sticks, and the boards. But job two, which is almost entirely ignored by beginners, is dictating exactly what your body is physically capable of executing biomechanically.
And the dual mandate is exactly what we are tearing apart today. Welcome to this deep dive, where we are going to master the intricacies of hockey equipment. We have a fascinating stack of sources for this one.
We really do.
We are working primarily from a comprehensive masterclass text called Equipment Learning to Play the Game. But we are also crossing that with peer-reviewed physics papers from Scientific Reports and parsing through the incredibly dense, almost legally binding rule books from USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, and the IIHF.
It's a lot of material, but it's vital.
Yeah, and the mission here isn't to just give you a shopping list. It's used to build an integrated mental model. We want you to understand the actual physics, the biomechanics, and the rulebook traps so thoroughly that you could walk into any locker room and immediately spot why someone in gear is actively working against them.
To do that properly, though, we really have to build the player from the ground up.
Literally.
Literally. We have to start at the absolute foundation, the point of contact where human anatomy meets a frozen sheet of water, the skates. Because if that interface fails, the rest of the gear is just irrelevant.
So let's talk about that interface, because the first major hurdle is sizing. And I think I know why people get this so wrong. We have been conditioned our entire lives on how to buy shoes.
Right, the sneaker mentality.
Exactly. You go to a shoe store, you take your standard street shoe size, maybe go up a half size to accommodate thick socks or a wide arch, and you check if you have some wiggle room in the toe. But applying that logic to a hockey skate seems to be the quickest way to ruin your mechanics.
Oh, it guarantees failure. A hockey skate is not a shoe, period. In a running shoe, your foot actually needs to articulate.
Because of the walking motion.
Right. The biomechanics of walking require your metatarsals to spread out and your heel to lift slightly as you roll off the ball of your foot. The shoe flexes to accommodate that dynamic movement.
But a skate doesn't do that.
Not at all. A modern hockey skate is a rigid carbon fiber or composite shell. It is not designed to flex around your foot. It is designed to lock your foot completely in place so that every micro movement of your leg is instantly transmitted to the steel blade.
Okay, so if I walk in wearing a size 10 sneaker and I ask the clerk for a size 10 skate, what is actually happening inside that boot when I get on the ice?
You are swimming in it. Hockey skates generally run a full size to a size and a half smaller than your street shoes.
Wow, a full size and a half.
Yeah. So if you are in a size 10 sneaker, you belong in an 8.5 or maybe a 9 skate. If you put on that size 10 skate, your heel is going to slip upwards every single time you push off. Your foot will slide laterally, and that internal movement completely destroys edge control.
Right, because edge control is a game of millimeters and precise angles.
Yeah.
I always assumed, edge control was just about balance, but it's really about ankle articulation, isn't it?
Exactly. To carve a sharp turn, you have to lean, drop your knee, and roll your ankle to tilt the blade into the ice.
So consider the geometry of that movement if the boot is too large.
Right, think about it. You drop your knee and you roll your ankle inside the boot. But because there is negative space slack, essentially between your foot and the rigid wall of the skate, your ankle moves 10 or 15 degrees before it even makes contact with the boot's structure.
Oh, so you're moving, but the skate isn't.
Precisely. By the time your foot actually hits the wall of the skate to transfer the energy, you've completely exhausted your anatomical range of motion. The blade itself never tilts, it stays completely flat, you lose the edge, and you just slide out into the boards.
And what is the immediate psychological reaction for a player when that happens? They get back to the bench and say, "Man, I just have weak ankles. I can't hold my edges." I have heard that exact phrase 100 times in recreational leagues.
It is the most common misdiagnosis in the entire sport. You do not have weak ankles. You have a loose boot.
That's a great way to put it.
It's the truth. If your heel can move even a fraction of an inch, or if you can wiggle your ankle laterally without the blade instantly mirroring that movement, your skates don't fit, period. When you sit down, kick your heel back, and lace up, moving your heel inside that pocket should be physically impossible.
And where should your toes be?
Your big toe should just feather the front cap, barely brushing it.
Okay, I understand that for adults. But let's look at this from a parent's perspective, because the financial reality of youth hockey is just brutal. Kids grow so fast. A decent pair of skates can run hundreds of dollars.
Which leads to the ultimate trap.
Right. The overwhelming temptation is to buy a skate a full size or two larger so the kid can, you know, grow into them.
And the source material is brutally uncompromising on this. You cannot do it. Buying a skate that is too large for a child is a false economy.
Why is it so damaging, though, beyond just poor performance?
Well, first, as we just discussed, they physically cannot learn proper skating mechanics. They will spend their entire season developing terrible flat-footed habits because they cannot engage their edges. But second, a foot sliding around inside a composite boot acts like sandpaper.
Oh, the friction.
Massive friction. It creates friction that will prematurely break down the internal foams and the structural shell, what we call the quarter package of the skate. You literally destroy the skate from the inside out before they ever grow into it.
The text specifically attacks this thing called the one finger trick. You know, the one a parent tells the kid to slide their foot all the way forward in an unlaced skate, and then the parent jams their index finger down behind the kid's heel.
Yeah, if the finger fits, they buy it. It's an outdated, actively harmful heuristic.
How much space should there actually be?
Think about the dimensions. An adult index finger is roughly 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch thick. The absolute maximum allowance for a growing child's foot is 1/4 inch of extra space in the heel.
So a finger's way too big.
Way too big. If you can easily fit a finger behind that heel, you are buying a boot that is 2 to 3 times too large for any functional heel lock.
So what should we remember here? What's the takeaway for the listener on sizing?
Buy skates 1 to 1.5 sizes smaller than your street shoes. Total heel lock is non-negotiable. And never buy big for a kid to grow into.
Okay, so we have the sizing nailed down. But let's talk about the material itself.
Mm.
Because the other variable on the wall at the pro shop is stiffness. You have the, like, $150 entry-level skates that are relatively pliable, and then the $1,000 flagship pro models that feel like they are carved out of solid marble.
And the trap here is the assumption that stiffer inherently equals faster.
Right. It's the assumption that buying pro-level gear magically grants you pro-level physics.
Exactly. But a hyper-stiff boot only works if you generate enough kinetic force to actually load it. You have to think of the skate boot like a suspension spring.
Okay, let me use a car analogy here. If I take the heavy-duty reinforced suspension spring off a commercial dump truck and I install it on a lightweight golf cart, what happens?
The golf cart doesn't become a better off-road vehicle.
Oh, right. It just bounces violently over every single pebble because it doesn't have the mass or the downward force to compress the spring.
That is the exact biomechanical equivalent. When a 200-pound NHL professional accelerates, they are driving immense downward and forward force through their shin, into the tongue, and into the boot of the skate. The boot gives slightly, absorbing and returning that energy.
Like loading a spring.
Right. But if a 150-pound beginner or recreational player puts on that same adamantium stiff boot, they hit a brick wall. They literally cannot bend their ankles forward.
And if you can't bend your ankle forward, you can't bend your knees. You end up skating completely upright.
Upright, stiff, and completely off balance. Your center of gravity remains way too high, and you lose all explosive power in your stride. You have to match the stiffness of the boot to your current physical strength and skating ability, not your ambition.
That is such a crucial point. match stiffness to your current ability. But there's a massive advantage to moving just one step up from the bottom tier entry skates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because once you get into the mid-range stiffness, you unlock thermoforming.
Yes, baking the skates. Thermoforming fundamentally changed the break-in process. Mid-range and high-end skates use specialized foams and resins in the quarter package that react to heat.
How does that work in the shop?
The shop will put the skates in a specialized convection oven, usually around 200 degrees Fahrenheit for a few minutes. The structural materials become pliable. You put them on, lace them tightly, and as they cool, they cure into the exact asymmetrical shape of your specific foot.
But the warning here is to never, ever try this at home. I've heard horror stories of people putting $600 skates in their kitchen oven next to a baking sheet and melting the plastic eyelets.
Or completely delaminating the carbon fiber. Kitchen ovens have localized heating elements that cause intense hot spots. Use the shop's specialized oven.
Right.
And equally important, when you are wearing the hot, pliable skates in the shop waiting for them to cool, do not stand up. Do not walk around.
Because your body weight will crush the softened arches.
Exactly. When the resin is hot, it is structurally vulnerable. If you stand, your full body weight pushes down, flattening the footbed and bowing the sides of the skate outward. You will permanently mold the skate into a widened, distorted shape.
So what's the proper posture?
You have to sit perfectly still for about 10 to 15 minutes, keeping your knees bent at a 90-degree angle until the boot cools and structurally resets.
Okay, let's move down to the very bottom of the skate, because this is where the physics get incredibly nuanced. The steel. A hockey blade is not a flat knife edge, is it?
No, not at all. It is actually ground down the middle to create a concave channel. When a sharpener runs the grinding wheel down the length of your blade, they are hollowing out the center.
And that concave groove leaves two distinct razor-sharp edges on the outside and the inside of the blade.
Yes, and the depth of that groove is referred to as the radius of hollow, or the ROH. It measured in fractions of an inch.
And this is where it gets super counterintuitive for a lot of people. The smaller the fraction, the deeper the cut. So a 38-inch hollow is a very deep, aggressive groove.
Mm.
A 58-inch hollow is a larger radius, so it creates a shallower, flatter groove.
Mm.
What does this actually mean for the player physically?
It dictates the perpetual trade-off between bite and glide. A deeper, hollow-like 38 of an inch creates very pronounced, almost fang-like edges that dig aggressively into the ice.
Giving you tons of grip.
Phenomenal bite. You can stop on a dime, you can carve incredibly tight turns without sliding out, and you have massive grip for explosive starts.
But there's a cost.
A massive cost to your glide. Because those edges are buried so deep in the ice, you are generating significantly more friction. The skates feel grabby or sluggish when you are just trying to coast. You have to expend more muscular energy just to maintain your top end speed.
Whereas if I go to a shallower hollow, like a 58, the edges don't penetrate as deeply. I get much better glide, higher top speed with less effort.
Right.
But if I try to turn too sharply, I might just blow a tire and slide sideways because I don't have enough edge gripping the ice.
Exactly. Larger, heavier players naturally push more weight into the ice so they can get away with shallower hollows and still get enough bite. Lighter players often need the deeper hollow just to grip the ice at all.
Now, this brings us to a really fascinating debate in the retail world that the source material highlights. It's about how ice temperature affects this equation.
Oh, this is a great example of conflicting advice.
It really is.
Yeah.
I love this because we have two major retailers giving completely contradictory advice to the public. Discount Hockey claims that if you are playing in a frigid, very cold rink, you should get a sharper, deeper hollow to help you dig into the hard ice.
But Pure Hockey publishes the exact opposite.
Right. They claim that cold ice inherently provides more bite, so you don't need a deep hollow.
It is a brilliant example of how conventional wisdom often fractures when it meets real-world variables. To solve this, we actually have to look at the thermodynamics of the ice itself. And this is where the 2025 review in Scientific Reports clears things up.
Let's break down that science.
Colder ice, say, ice maintained at 18 degrees Fahrenheit versus a slushier 24 degrees, has a much more rigid crystalline structure. The hydrogen bonds in the water lattice are physically stronger. It is physically harder ice.
Which means Pure Hockey's claim that cold ice gives you more bite is scientifically backward. If the surface is harder, a steel blade is going to have a much more difficult time penetrating it.
Precisely. Discount Hockey understands the physics. To get the equivalent amount of edge penetration on 18-degree ice as you do on 24-degree ice, you would mathematically need a deeper, sharper hollow to cut through that harder surface.
So, case closed. Everyone should carry a thermometer in their bag and change their sharpening specs based on the arena's HVAC system.
No, absolutely not. And that, sir, the theory fails in practical application. The actual mandate for the player is ignore the temperature and leave your hollow alone.
Wait, why? If the physics dictated change, why wouldn't you adapt?
Because of neuroplasticity and proprioception.
Meaning your body's awareness of itself.
Exactly. Your brain and your nervous system heavily calibrate your balance and your muscle firing patterns to the specific friction feedback of your skates. If you are constantly changing your hollow from 12-inch to 38 to 58 trying to chase the perfect feeling, you destroy your body's baseline.
Ah, so you don't know what normal feels like anymore.
Right. If you fall on a tight turn, you won't know how to correct it. Was the ice too soft? Was your knee bend wrong? Or was your new hollow just too shallow? You eliminate the ability to diagnose your own technique.
So the rule is, find a standard, hollow half an inch is the industry standard, and just adapt your body to it. Set it and forget it. And speaking of diagnosing problems, how do I know when that hollow is actually gone? When do I know it's time to sharpen? A lot of people just drag their fingernail across a blade to see if it scrapes off some nail dust, but that seems pretty imprecise.
It is. The visual light test is far superior.
Why do you do that?
Hold your skate upside down under a bright, harsh light source. Look straight down the length of the edge. A properly sharpened microscopic edge is so fine that it does not reflect light back up at you. It looks dark or almost invisible.
And if it's dull?
If you look down and you see a shiny silver reflection glaring back along the edge, that means the steel has rounded over. The edge has been flattened into a tiny reflective surface. The moment you see that glare, you've lost your bite.
So to recap this entire foundation of the lower body for the listener.
Yeah.
Lock the heel, size down by 1 to 1.5 sizes, match the stiffness to your leg strength so you can actually bend your knees, and maintain a consistent radius of hollow so your brain can calibrate to the friction.
That establishes the platform. You are now anchored to the ice, and you can generate power, but all that power is completely useless if you can manipulate the object of the game.
Which naturally transitions us from the skates to the hands. Let's examine the stick.
And the source makes a profound point right away here. A stick is not a brand.
Right. People get so caught up in the marketing, they want a specific Bauer or CCM model because their favorite NHL player uses it. But a stick is essentially just a four-variable mathematical tool. Length, flex, curve, and lie.
Yes. If those four numbers don't match your body, the brand logo on the carbon fiber is completely irrelevant.
Let's isolate those variables, starting with length. The traditional heuristic is that in your street shoes, the stick should reach your nose. On your skates, it should reach your chin. But that is highly dependent on position and playing style, isn't it?
Heavily dependent. Because length dictates leverage and reach, you'll see defensemen using much longer sticks, sometimes coming up to their eyebrows, even on skates.
Why do defensemen want that extra length?
For a defenseman, reach is currency. A longer lever allows you to execute poke checks from a safer distance. It increases your wingspan for intercepting cross-ice passes, and it allows you to keep the puck further away from your body when you are walking the blue line to find a shooting lane.
But that length comes at a cost, right?
A huge cost to close quarters handling.
Which is why forwards, especially centers who are digging in the corners, tend to prefer shorter sticks, maybe down to their collarbone. They need to handle the puck in a telephone booth right by their skates, without the butt end of the stick catching on their jersey or their ribs.
Exactly. But altering the length introduces the most dangerous trap in equipment fitting, which brings us to the second variable, flex.
Flex is the stiffness rating of the shaft. It's a literal measurement, the number of pounds of force required to bend the shaft exactly 1 inch. So a 100 flex stick requires 100 pounds of downward force to deflect an inch.
And this is critical because a hockey shot is not a golf swing. You are not just sweeping the blade through the puck.
How does the shot actually work then?
A powerful wrist shot or slap shot relies on the stick acting as a loaded spring. The player drives the blade into the ice slightly behind the puck. This downward force bends the carbon fiber shaft, storing kinetic energy like drawing a bowstring.
And then it releases.
Yes. As the blade snaps forward and releases from the ice, all that stored energy violently unloads through the puck.
The standard advice is to start with a flex that is roughly half your body weight.
Yeah.
So a 180-pound player should start looking at a 90 flex stick.
Yeah.
But here is the massive trap that the source warns about, and it goes right back to the length variable.
The cutting trap.
Right. Let's say I weigh 160 pounds. I buy an 80 flex stick. Perfect. Half my weight. But I wear a center, and it feels a little too long for in-tight puck handling, so I take it to the garage, take out a hacksaw, and cut 4 inches off the top. I've customized my length, and I still have my 80 flex rate.
No, you have completely destroyed the flex rating. By cutting the stick, you have fundamentally altered its physics. You made it significantly stiffer.
Because of the leverage. It's like trying to snap a wooden pencil in half. A full-length pencil is easy to bend, but if you try to snap a 2-inch stub of a pencil, it feels like solid steel because you don't have the leverage.
Exactly. The flex rating of 80 was calculated based on the original length of the lever. When you cut 4 inches off the top, you shorten the distance between your top hand and the blade. It now requires substantially more force to achieve that 1 inch of deflection.
So what is that 80 flex stick actually performing at now?
Your 80 flex stick is now operating like a 95 flex stick. For a 160-pound player, that means the stick is now a rigid board. You will not be able to load the shaft, you will get zero spring effect, and your shots will be weak flutters because you are relying entirely on arm muscle.
So what's the practical application of this rule? What should the listener do if they know they need a shorter stick?
If you know you prefer a shorter stick, you have to buy a lower flex out of the gate. If you plan to cut 3 inches off, maybe start with a 70 flex so that it artificially stiffens up into an 80 when you cut it.
That is an incredibly practical piece of advice. Let's look at the third variable, which is where players try to buy skill instead of developing it, the curve. Specifically, the face angle of the blade.
This is a huge issue for beginners.
You can break the face angle down into open versus closed, which is perfectly analogous to the locked on a set of golf clubs. If you hold a stick straight up and look down at the blade, an open face means the blade is tilted backward, exposing the front face to the ceiling. It looks like a 9-iron or a pitching wedge. A closed face is much more vertical, like a 3-iron.
And open faces are wildly popular in retail shops because they provide instant gratification.
How so?
An open face acts as a ramp. You can scoop the puck and easily flip it under the crossbar from 2 feet away without applying any real technique. It feels great. You feel like a pro, but it is a developmental crutch that carries a severe, unavoidable penalty to the rest of your game.
Because whatever you do to the front of the blade inherently changes the back of the blade.
Yes. Think about the geometry. If the front forehand side of the blade is open and tilted backward to create a scoop, the backhand side of the blade is now sloped downwards toward the ice like a ski hill.
So when you try to take a backhand shot or receive a backhand pass, the puck just ramps right off the blade. There's no cup to catch it.
And the backhand is arguably the most dangerous, deceptive shot in hockey because goalies cannot read the release point. By choosing an aggressively open forehand curve, you are effectively castrating your backhand capabilities.
So beginners should stay away from open faces.
Beginners should always favor a closed or neutral face angle. It forces you to learn the actual biomechanics of weight transfer and wrist roll to elevate the puck, rather than relying on a wedge to do it for you.
Which brings us to the final stick variable, and honestly, the one that almost nobody outside of pro equipment managers actually talks about, the lie.
The lie is crucial. It is the angle between the vertical shaft of the stick and the horizontal blade. It dictates how upright the stick must be held for the blade to sit perfectly flat on the ice.
It usually represented by a number, right?
Yes, usually between 4.0 and 6.0. A higher number, like 6.0, means a more upright angle, suited for players who skate tall with the puck close to their feet. A lower number, like 4.0, is better for players who skate low and wide, pushing the puck further out in front of them.
And the mechanical failure here is pretty obvious. If you have the wrong lie, your blade is physically incapable of resting flat on the ice during your normal skating posture. Either the toe of the blade is pointing up in the air, or the heel of the blade is lifting off the ice.
And if the blade isn't flat, your margin for error just completely disappears. Hard passes will skip right under the lifted toe or heel. When you shoot, the puck rolls off the uneven surface rather than transferring energy cleanly. It ruins accuracy and puck retention.
But diagnosing this is remarkably easy. The source provides a brilliant diagnostic test that you can do in 10 seconds without any specialized tools.
Look at the tape on the bottom of your blade after a few hours of playing. The friction of the ice will naturally wear the tape away.
And what are we looking for?
If you have the correct lie, the tape will be worn evenly across the entire bottom edge from heel to toe. That means the entire blade is making contact. But if only the tape on the very front toe is worn down to the fiberglass, or if only the heel is shredded while the rest of the tape looks brand new, your lie is completely wrong for your biomechanics.
You are playing the game using only an inch of your blade.
Exactly.
So let's review the stick section. Specs over brands. Calculate your flex based on the cut length. avoid open-face crutches to save your backhand, and read your tape to check your lie.
That covers the performance hardware.
Right. At this point, we have optimized the performance hardware. The player can move, and the player can manipulate the puck. But hockey is a collision sport, so we need to shift our focus to survival. Let's talk about the armor.
And the paradox of protective equipment is that the instinct to maximize safety often results in maximizing danger. The governing principle here is dislocation.
Right, the idea that a bigger pad is a better pad. A player looks at an elbow pad in the store, thinks, I want maximum coverage, and buys a size large, even though they are a medium. They assume more foam equals more safety. But why is that a critical error?
Because kinetic energy doesn't care about the total surface area of foam you are wearing. It cares about what is covering the exact point of impact at the microsecond of the collision.
The specific joint.
Right. Protective gear is designed with specific hard caps, like the kneecap or the olecranon cap on the elbow, that must stay perfectly centered over the joint to disperse force.
And if the gear is too large, it shifts.
Exactly. When you take a heavy body check or dive to block a shot, the deceleration and the violent movement of your body will cause loose, oversized gear to slide out of position. The pad arrives somewhere other than where the puck does.
That is a terrifying thought.
It is. A massive elbow pad is completely useless if the cap has slid down your forearm, leaving the actual joint completely exposed to the ice.
The source outlines three specific, notorious danger gaps where this fit failure happens most frequently.
Mm.
The first one is a classic. The gap between the shin guard and the hockey pants.
This is a prime target zone for rising slap shots, aggressive stick slashes, and catching the top edge of the boards during a hip check. The mistake always happens in the dressing room.
How do people mess this up?
A player puts on their shin guards and their pants, stands completely upright, looks in the mirror, and sees that the bottom of the pants touches the top of the shin guard. They think they are fully covered.
But the game is played in flexion.
Yes. The moment you drop into an aggressive, deep skating stance, your quadriceps engage, and the pants ride several inches up your thigh. Suddenly, a massive 2 or 3 inch gap of unprotected bare thigh opens up right above the knee.
So how do you test for it correctly?
To test this properly, you cannot stand straight in the pro shop. You must drop into a deep hockey stance. The bottom of the pants must significantly overlap the top of the shin guard in that flex position so that the gap never opens during play.
Got it. Gap number two is the elbow rotation we just touched on.
This is how catastrophic olecranon fractures happen. If the straps on your elbow pads are degraded, or if the pad is simply too voluminous for your arm, the pad won't just slide up or down, it will rotate radially.
Around the arm?
Yes. When you fall backward and brace yourself, the friction against the ice will grab the edge of the pad and literally spin it around your arm. The hard plastic cap rotates to the soft inner bicep, and you slam the fragile point of your bare elbow directly onto the concrete hard ice.
So it has to be tight.
You must strap that pad tight enough that you physically cannot twist it around your arm with your opposite hand.
And the third gap is the wrist. That little sliver of real estate between the cuff of the glove and the bottom of the elbow pad.
It's highly vulnerable to slashes, but more terrifyingly, it is vulnerable to skate lacerations during goal mouth scrambles. Properly fitted gloves should interface cleanly with the elbow pad, leaving zero exposed skin.
But that's hard to maintain while playing.
Because players constantly flex their wrists, that gap is bound to open momentarily. That is why bodies like USA Hockey and the IIHF are increasingly pushing players to wear cut-resistant, Kevlar-style undersleeves that cover the wrist entirely, rendering the gap moot.
So what's the key takeaway for armor? Fit is safety. A pad that moves is a pad that fails. Always test gaps in a bent hockey posture.
Exactly.
Now, we are moving up the body to the most vital organ. We are talking about the brain. Helmets and masks. And I want to set this up carefully, because this is where the source material drops its strictest, most uncompromising rules.
We are talking about traumatic brain injuries, rotational forces, and CTE. There is no room for error here.
Let's address the secondhand market, because parents do this all the time. A 15-year-old outgrows their helmet. The 12-year-old needs one. The parent looks at the older kid's helmet. There are no visible cracks in the plastic. It looks pristine. Is it safe to pass that down?
Absolutely not. Never buy, borrow, or hand down a used helmet, period.
Why is it so dangerous if it looks fine?
To understand why, you have to understand how the internal foams, usually expanded polystyrene or expanded polypropylene, actually manage kinetic energy. They do not act like a bouncy rubber ball. They act like a crumple zone in a car.
meaning they sacrifice themselves to save the passenger.
Exactly. When a 90-mile-an-hour puck strikes a helmet, the outer polycarbonate shell disperses the localized force across a wider area, but it raws the internal foam that actually absorbs the energy. The microscopic cell walls within the foam crush and compress.
And that compression slows the impact.
Yes. This compression takes a few milliseconds, which slows down the deceleration of the skull, reducing the G-force applied to the brain.
But once those microscopic cells are crushed, they don't magically reinflate.
They are permanently compromised. A crushed foam liner has lost its ability to absorb the next impact. The terrifying reality is that you cannot see this compression with the naked eye. The foam might look perfectly intact.
And the shell.
You cannot see microscopic hairline fractures within the plastic shell that compromise its structural integrity. A helmet can look showroom new on the outside and be completely structurally dead on the inside. You cannot verify the impact history of a used helmet, which makes wearing it a reckless gamble.
This applies heavily to loner pools as well, right? A lot of kids get introduced to the sport through try hockey for free days, where the local rink provides massive bags of communal gear.
Communal gear is excellent for shoulder pads and shin guards, but a communal helmet is a massive risk. That helmet has been on 50 different heads. It has hit the ice, taken errant stick blows, and absorbed pucks for years. Nobody at the rink is keeping a detailed impact logbook for helmet number 14.
That makes total sense.
USA Hockey implicitly acknowledges this. Even in their gear-provided introductory programs, they strongly recommend that parents bring their own properly fitted new helmet for their child.
And we have to shine a light on the goaltenders here, because this is a huge blind spot. The goalie's trap.
Goalie equipment is prohibitively expensive. A full set can easily run $3,000 to $5,000. So naturally, beginners and casual fill-in goalies borrow the club's spare gear.
Which is fine for the leg pads, right?
Borrowing the heavy leg pads, the blocker, and the chest protector is fine. But people categorize the goalie mask as another piece of goalie gear.
When in reality, it is a helmet. In fact, it is the one helmet on the ice guaranteed to take direct high-velocity impacts.
A club goalie mask has had frozen rubber fired at it at high speeds for years. Its structural integrity is highly suspect. The absolute rule is, borrow the bulky pads to save money, but always buy your own brand new certified mask.
Let's talk about those certifications, because this dictates whether a referee will even allow you on the ice. The bureaucracy of safety is highly regional.
Very regional. If you are playing in the United States under USA hockey rules, your helmet must have a valid HECC sticker. That's the Hockey Equipment Certification Council. And HECC has a very strict timeline.
What's your timeline?
The certification expires exactly 6.5 years after the date of manufacture printed on the sticker.
Which creates an infuriating situation I call the expiry trap.
Right. You could buy a brand new top-tier helmet, leave it in its original box in a climate-controlled closet for 7 years and take it out. It has never seen the ice. It has never taken an impact.
But legally?
Because that HECC sticker is expired by 6 months, it is legally unplayable in any USA Hockey-sanctioned youth game. If the referee checks the helmet, and they do, you will be sent to the locker room.
But if I drive 3 hours north into Canada, the rules change entirely.
Hockey Canada explicitly states that HECC stickers are irrelevant. You must have a CSA sticker, the Canadian Standards Association. And fascinatingly, CSA certification does not have a strict expiry date.
So how do they manage safety?
They place the onus on the user and the officials to inspect the helmet for degradation or damage. Meanwhile, if you cross the Atlantic to Europe or the UK, they rely on the CE mark and the EN ISO 10256 international standard.
Which means the expiration date on a US helmet only measures the passage of time. It's a legal liability measure. It tells you absolutely nothing about the physical integrity of the foam. A helmet could be 2 weeks old and completely destroyed internally from a massive hit, but legally, it's valid. That's why you have to inspect the gear, not just read the sticker.
Precisely. Which naturally transitions us into the most complex part of this entire deep dive, how the rule book governs the gear.
Yes, the legal landscape.
Mm-hmm.
It is wild how equipment rules vary across borders far more than the actual rules of play. I mean, an offside is an offside in Toronto, Chicago, and London.
Yeah.
But what you wear dictates whether you get a penalty, get ejected, or even get to play at all.
The sharpest, most controversial divergence in the global game right now is the neck guard mandate. We have to issue a very specific warning to our UK listeners here because the contrast with North America is staggering.
Let's lay out the map. In the U.S., under USA Hockey, neck laceration protectors are currently required for youth players, but adults are entirely exempt. In Canada, they are required for all minor and female hockey. But if you play in the UK,
If you play anywhere in the home countries, England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, you are governed by the IIHF rulebook combined with strict domestic regulations. Following a highly publicized tragic incident, the UKAI implemented a zero tolerance policy.
what does that mean, practical?
A neck laceration protector is absolutely mandatory for every single player on the ice at every single age level. There are no adult exemptions. Whether you are a 10-year-old beginner or a 40-year-old beer league veteran, you must wear one.
And the enforcement is ruthless. There are no warnings.
None. If you step onto the ice for warm-ups or a game without a neck guard, the official will immediately assess a 10-minute misconduct penalty. You sit in the box. If you forget it a second time in the same game, it escalates to a game misconduct and you are ejected.
But the craziest part of this rule is how it applies during active play. Say I'm wearing one and a Velcro strap degrades, and the neck guard falls off onto the ice during a shift. My natural human instinct is to stop, bend over, pick it up, and reattach it.
Do not do that. Under UK rules, if a piece of mandatory safety equipment falls off, you are considered an illegal player. You must abandon the play and leave the ice immediately. You cannot stop to retrieve it.
So who gets it?
You must skate directly to the bench and let the official or a teammate pick it up during a stoppage. If you start to pick it up or try to put it back on while on the ice, you will be hit with that 10-minute misconduct.
Connecting this back to North America, Canada is currently facing a looming regulatory crisis regarding neck guards, the BNQ certification issue.
Right. Hockey Canada mandates that neck guards must be BNQ certified. BNQ is the independent standards body that tests the cut resistance of the materials. The crisis is that the BNQ has officially announced they are shutting down their neck protector certification program on July 31st, 2027.
And they have made it clear they are not opening a replacement program.
Exactly.
So what happens on August 1st, 2027?
Nobody knows. It is a massive gray area. Hockey Canada has not yet published what standard they will accept once BNQ ceases operations. The practical advice for players right now is to buy a currently certified BNQ protector, ensure the label remains legible, and aggressively monitor communications from your local hockey association regarding what the protocol will be for the 2027-2028 season. Do not assume the rule is vanishing just because the testing body is closing.
Let's shift from the neck to the head, the helmet off protocols. Because again,
Yeah.
your reaction to losing your helmet has to change depending on what country you are standing in.
If you watch the NHL on television, you'll see players lose their helmet, calmly pick it up, strap it back on, and jump back into the play. That is legal under their specific professional rules. Do not emulate that in amateur hockey.
Because if I do that under USA hockey rules,
Yeah.
what happens?
Under USA hockey, if a player's helmet comes off, the referee blows the whistle and stops play immediately, regardless of who has the puck or if there is a scoring chance. The risk of head trauma overrides the flow of the game.
But in the UK and under IIHF rules, play actually continues, right?
Yes, play continues, but the player who lost their helmet must act instantly. Just like the neck guard rule, you must sprint directly to the player's bench. You are strictly forbidden from participating in the play, and you are forbidden from picking the helmet up to put it back on. If you linger on the ice or attempt to restrap it, it's penalty.
And USA Hockey has an incredibly strict rule regarding helmets and altercations. Fights.
It is severely penalized. You see it in classic hockey movies. Two players square off, and to show they mean business, they dramatically unbuckle and pull their own helmets off before throwing a punch.
It looks cinematic, but it is a legal nightmare now.
Under USA Hockey, deliberately removing your own helmet or your opponent's helmet prior to or during an altercation results in a match penalty.
And a match penalty isn't just sitting in the box for a few minutes. It is the nuclear option.
It is the harshest penalty in the amateur rulebook. It entails immediate ejection from the game, a 5-minute major penalty that your team must serve shorthanded, and an automatic indefinite suspension from all USA Hockey sanctioned games and practices pending a formal disciplinary hearing. The governing body recognizes that an unhelmeted head hitting the ice during a fight is a catastrophic liability. They have legislated it out of the game with extreme prejudice.
Let's look at one more incredibly common scenario where the rules dictate your reaction. The broken stick. You take a massive slap shot, the composite shaft shatters, and you are left holding a jagged carbon fiber spear.
The universal rule for skaters, regardless of region, is to drop the broken piece immediately. A broken stick is instantly classified as illegal equipment.
So you can't even hold it.
No. If you try to play the puck with it, or even if you just carry it in your hand while skating back to the bench to get a new one, you will be penalized. In the UK, carrying it for even a few strides is a minor penalty. Open your hand and drop it exactly where you stand.
But wait, I've seen this happen. A player drops it, but its shoe's in the middle of the slot. They want to be polite and ensure nobody trips over it, so they scoop up the broken halves and toss them gently over the glass into the netting or the penalty box.
If you try to be polite by throwing a stick over the glass, you are out of the game. Discarding a broken stick over the boards is a mandatory misconduct in North America, and under IIHF rules, an intentional throw over the glass is a game misconduct. You are ejected.
Wow, so how do you clear it safely?
The only legal way a player can clear a broken stick is to use their skates or a new stick to push it flat along the ice toward the sideboards.
But what if it's the goalie's stick that breaks? The paddle snaps. Can a goalie just keep using the broken stick?
Once again, the rule book splinters. If you are playing in the NHL or under IIHF rules, yes, the goalie is granted an exception and can continue playing with a broken stick until the next whistle, provided it isn't dangerously splintered.
But under North American amateur rules.
Under USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, that exception does not exist. The goalie must drop the broken stick immediately, exactly like a skater. If they attempt to make a save with a broken stick, they take a penalty.
So now the goalie has no stick. A skater naturally wants to give the goalie their stick to help out.
And they can. A skater is legally allowed to hand their regular stick to the goalie, and the goalie can use it. But the operative word is hand.
I'm glad you emphasized that because the source material has a terrifying scenario for Canadian players about how you deliver that stick. You cannot slide it across the ice to them.
It is a disaster cascade. Under Hockey Canada rules, if a skater slides a stick across the ice to a teammate, it is a minor penalty for throwing a stick. But if a skater slides that stick to their goalie while they are inside their own defending zone, the penalty escalates drastically.
What happens?
It results in a penalty shot being awarded to the opposing team. And if the goalie actually receives and picks up the slid stick, the goalie receives an additional minor penalty for playing with illegal equipment.
So, out of a desire to be helpful, you've given the other team a penalty shot and put your team shorthanded. Hand it directly to the goalie, hand to hand. Do not slide it. Let's review. UK rules demand neck guards unconditionally. Helmets off means play stops in the US, but you leave the ice in the UK and drop broken sticks instantly.
It's a lot of rules, but they are critical for compliance.
Let's bring it all home with the final aspect of the equipment life cycle. The unsung heroes. Tape, maintenance, and pregame routines, because how you treat your gear in the trunk of your car dictates how it performs on the ice.
And this brings us to the most unglamorous but necessary mandate, the drying mandate. Moisture is the ultimate enemy of hockey equipment.
Everyone knows the smell of a hockey bag that has been left zipped up in a warm garage for a week. It smells like a biohazard. But it's not just an odor problem, is it? It's a literal microbiology problem.
The smell is just the off-gassing of bacteria multiplying. A dark, humid hockey bag filled with sweat-soaked organic material is a perfect incubator. We're talking about serious pathogens, MRSA, staph infections, and tinea pedis.
Which is really dangerous in a sport like hockey.
Very dangerous. Hockey is a rough sport. You constantly have small abrasions, cuts, and friction burns on your skin. If you put on damp, bacteria-ridden shoulder pads, those microcuts become direct entry points for severe, sometimes hospitalization-level infections.
But the mandate is airflow.
Absolute. Immediate airflow. The moment you get home, the bag must be unzipped and completely emptied. Hang the gear on a drying rack. Point a high-velocity fan at it.
And moisture breaks down the gear structurally too, doesn't it?
Oh, structurally, it is just as destructive. Prolonged dampness rots the nylon stitching, degrades the impact-absorbing foams, and violently oxidizes the high-carbon steel of your skate blades.
Which is why you should never store your skates in those soft cloth blade covers, the soakers. People think they're protecting the blade, but if the blade is wet, the cloth acts like a sponge, holding the moisture directly against the steel and accelerating rust.
Precisely. Wipe the steel dry with a towel and store them openly. Let the air hit them.
Finally, let's debunk a locker room myth, the tape myth. Players are highly superstitious about stick tape, black tape, white tape, candy cane stripes. But the age-old lore is that wrapping your blade in black tape acts as camouflage, hiding the black puck from the goalie's eyes. Does the source material back this up?
It thoroughly debunks it. There is zero peer-reviewed data or visual science supporting the idea that black tape hides a moving puck from a professional goaltender. It is pure confirmation bias and locker room folklore.
So the goalies can see it just fine.
In fact, David Marcoux, a highly respected former NHL goalie coach, argues the exact inverse. He points out that from a goaltender's visual perspective, tracking a black puck coming off a bright white stick blade is actually easier because the high contrast highlights the exact release point.
So tape your stick however it makes you feel confident, but don't assume you are gaining some sort of optical illusion advantage over the goalie.
Exactly. Focus on the mechanics, not the optics.
Which brings us to the synthesis of this entire deep dive. We have covered a massive amount of technical ground today, from the molecular hardness of cold ice to the legal ramifications of dropping a broken stick.
To tie all of this into a cohesive mental model, you have to look at hockey equipment as a triad, a three-legged stool. It is a constant balance of fit, certification, and compliance.
Let's break that triad down for the listener one last time.
First, fit. As we discussed with skates and sticks, fit dictates physics. Your gyu defines your biomechanics. If the boot is loose, you lose your edge angle. If the stick is cut too short, you ruin the leverage of the flex. Second is certification, which dictates safety. This is understanding that a helmet EPS foam is a single-use crumple zone. A sticker doesn't mean it's safe. The structural integrity of the foam means it's safe.
And the third leg is compliance, which dictates legality.
Exactly. Knowing that what you wear and how you react when it breaks or falls off is governed by a strict, highly regional rulebook. You can have perfectly fitted, perfectly certified gear, but if you take your helmet off during a fight in a USA hockey game or refuse to wear a neck guard in the UK, your gear has just gotten you ejected from the game.
Fit, certification, compliance. If you internalize those three pillars, you aren't just blindly buying gear anymore. You understand the architecture of the sport. You will be safer, your kinetic energy transfer will be infinitely more efficient, and you won't accidentally hand the other team a penalty shot because you slid a stick to your goalie.
It fundamentally elevates how you interact with the game. But as we wrap up this analysis, there is a lingering, almost philosophical question that arises from looking at these disjointed rule books.
What's that?
We've spent a lot of time analyzing the legal landscape, how the UK enforces zero-tolerance neck guards while North America leaves adults largely exempt, how USA hockey issues match penalties for removing a helmet while other leagues are more lenient. The rules are severely fractured along geographic lines.
Completely siloed.
So as sports science continues to advance, as we map out the undeniable, devastating long-term impacts of microtraumas, rotational forces on the brain, and severe lacerations, will the global game of hockey eventually be forced to unify under one single universal standard of armor?
That is a phenomenal question.
Or will regional traditions, local cultures, and the stubbornness of how the game used to be played always dictate how we suit up?
Are we moving toward universal, scientifically backed safety? Or will the rulebook always depend on which side of an imaginary border you are standing on? Something to chew on the next time you are lacing up your skates, which, remember, need to be a size and a half smaller than your sneakers. Treat your Formula One chassis with the precision it deserves and don't settle for minivan tires. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the mechanics, and we will see you next time.